Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. So another very busy programme and a full studio today because Aina has come all the way up from County Clare to be with us in studio today in Dublin, and Niall Hatch has travelled in from County Wicklow. Aina, you're back in Dublin for good, are you?
No, well, I'm back in Dublin for good at the end of October, so I'm peripatetic at the minute. I'm travelling.
Oh, God bless you. Yeah, you can take a tablet for that.
Sure, there you go. I have a very full studio. I just want a little slim me here. I take objection to the fact that
I say it's
now
full because
crowded
we've
gotten
so used in the last 2 years to having nobody in the studio, just me and all of you guys remotely, and then lately Niall would come in occasionally and now more regularly, and now I've got an extra body in the studio, so it feels very full.
So there's a disease called being afraid of crowds. You wouldn't want to start worrying, Derek.
I tell you, I scrub everything before you guys come in. I'm still sanitising. Sanitise this, sanitise that, sanitise the other. I'm sanitised mad. How are you, Niall?
I'm very good, Derek, and it is nice to have company in here. It's great.
Thank
absolutely
you,
not that you're not great company yourself.
Oh, no,
Derek,
I didn't say
that
anything. No, I shouldn't have said anything. Let's say hello to Terry Flanagan. Bail me out, Terry. Bail me out. Where are you?
Well, I'm at home, Derek. I'm enjoying myself here at home, enjoying retirement, getting out plenty, I must say. The weather's been a little bit wet lately, but it has been a beautiful autumn. It really, really has. And I was amazed with the colours that I've seen over the last while. In fact, I went off for a walk there the day before yesterday. I normally go up the canal every day with the dog, but I decided to venture a little bit further. So I headed out to Leakslip, somewhere I'd never really been on the canal. Went to see the Leakslip Spa. There's a beautiful spa there and a waterfall there. And it's really a pity that it has become derelict. It really would be a great tourist attraction. And then they've got the aqueduct there where the canal goes across the River Rye. So there's lots of really enjoyable places to get out to see when you have the time.
Nat King Cole has a lovely song about autumn leaves. I'll play it for you in a moment, Terry, if you'd like. Richard Collins is in Malahide. Richard, you'd remember Nat King Cole, wouldn't you? He's your era.
I can remember the name, but I couldn't name you a song he sang, unfortunately, at this remote stage.
Now, what's all this about you believing that when you get to a certain age, you're sexless?
Who told you that? This is a dreadful thing to be saying. The theory I was putting out that sexual division is a kind of temporary state, and that once one passes beyond, it's a menopausal type thing where people of my age are there as filing cabinets for the wisdom and information they have to impart to the young, their grandchildren in this case. We are a source of wisdom should adversity strike, such as COVID, for instance. The great flu of 1918 would be remembered by some people at the outbreak of COVID. Now, perhaps in 70 years' time, my grandchildren will remember COVID when the next horror comes. So our function is no longer to reproduce, which is what sex is about, after all.
Oh, I see.
Our function is to impart knowledge and be a stabilizing influence on the younger generations in that way to help them survive.
Speak for yourself, Richard Collins. You needn't speak for all people that are slightly more mature. The thing is that it doesn't have to be either or. You can be full of wisdom, and I take exception to the fact that sex is just for having children. We're humans after all. We're not coming into heat once a year, so why would it be like this otherwise? I think you have completely outstepped the mark. I think you should speak for yourself as a male of an indeterminate age. This may be your lot in life, but it sure ain't the lot of the rest of us.
Terry, you've retired recently. Do you agree with this?
Well, I can't say too much because present Mrs. Flanagan, she wouldn't be too happy. So I'm going to play dumb on this one.
Dead right. Okay, now, Niall, you have a story for me about Buick swans.
Yes, the Buick swan, a really nice bird, one of my favourites, and one of three swans that we have here in Ireland. Just to break down what they are, the most familiar swan to most people will be the Muse swan. That's the swan that you often see in urban parks and on duck ponds and so on. That graceful curved neck, the orange beak with the black bump on it on the forehead. And that's with us year round. So we have that in Ireland throughout all 12 months of the year. But then in the winter time, we get two other species of swan that migrate here just for the winter period. One is the whooper swan, which comes to us from Iceland. It's roughly the same size as a mute swan, a little bit lighter in weight, but still a very large white bird. But it has a very sort of slender, sort of streamlined profiled beak that's partially yellow and partially black. So it looks quite different from a mute swan. Also holds its neck a bit straighter. And they're doing quite well. We're getting increasing numbers of those coming to Ireland. Then there's the Bewick swan, which is the smallest of the three. In many ways, it looks like a slightly smaller version of the whooper swan with that yellow and black beak, but it has a smaller amount of yellow on the beak than the whooper swan does. And the mute swan, it famously is more or less mute. It doesn't make any sort of major vocal noises. They make hissing sounds when they're agitated or whatever, but they don't make any of these bugling or trumpeting sounds. The whooper swan, which whoops, and the Bewick swan, which makes a similar sound make.
Where does the Bewick swan come from?
The Bewick swan comes to us from Siberia. So they're an Asian bird. So we're at the very western edge of their migratory range, whereas the whooper swan, which is found across the northern hemisphere, the main population that come to this part of Europe are coming from Iceland. So we're their first port of call. And I think that's really explaining the differences in the success and the fortunes of these two species. Because every few years across Britain and Ireland, and indeed other European countries as well, there's an international swan census that takes place. And Birdwatch Ireland is responsible for coordinating that here in the Republic of Ireland. So the last count for the census was in January of last year, and obviously it takes a while to process the data. So we've known the figures for Ireland for a while, but we've just seen now that the figures for UK and Ireland combined have been released. What they've shown is a massive drop in the number of Bewick swans that are now wintering in these islands, which is quite stark. So if we go back to 2010, so the one of the previous surveys, there were just over 7,100 pairs of these Bewick swans wintering in Britain and in Ireland, whereas last winter there were just 1,278 of them. But actually, shockingly, remarkably, only 12 of those were in Ireland, 12 individuals.
That's incredible. 12 only.
Yes, it was once our most common swan.
I remember some years ago with Richard, we went to a farm. I can't remember where the farm was, Richard, but it was full of Bewick swans. Do you remember?
Yes, I have great memories of Bewick swans, particularly because Slimbridge in Gloucestershire was the great place to see them in these islands. And I remember back in the 60s when Mary Evans was researching them there, going over to Slimbridge. I have one magical experience. At night, they turned the floodlights on and put out food in front of the viewing place, and hundreds of Bewicks came in gleaming white. Now, what they used to do was photograph every single bird, the beak. The black pattern and the yellow pattern was unique on each bird, so you could identify each bird on sight. And they did this for thousands of Bewicks at that time. Now, of course, they are all gone. Now, I don't think one should panic, because it's probably due to short stopping. Remember, you're in Siberia, you're a Bewick swan, and you're going to fly all the way to Ireland. Well, now, if you could avoid the long journey, you would. Now, with global warming, Europe is warming up a bit. The conditions are getting better in winter, so it isn't necessary to go so far. The cold is not driving them in the way it did in the past. So birds are short-stopping along the route in Scandinavia, in Germany, in the Netherlands, and fewer are reaching Slimbridge in England, or reaching the Sloblands here in Ireland. They still come to the Slobs, a few of them every year. I think there are a few this year. Niall could tell us the numbers on that. But it is a short stopping problem.
So you're saying they're not dead, they're just not coming here?
Well, now, that is a tricky one, because we have great figures for Britain and Ireland and for the Netherlands and for Germany. We haven't got such good figures elsewhere. Now, there does seem to be, in general, a decline in the numbers of Bewick swans generally. Now, perhaps they're going elsewhere, but short stopping is certainly a great factor in this.
But then the short stopping should work the two ways. So if we're getting fewer Bewick swans, which come to us all the way from Siberia, surely then, on the other hand, the ones that come from Iceland to Europe, surely we're the first port of call for them. And they should actually be increasing and saying, sure, it's grand in Ireland, we're not going on any further, we're not going on to other parts of Europe, we don't need to. So is there a reciprocal rise in the hooper swans?
There is, in a sense. Remember, Iceland's different. It's 800 kilometres, the shortest point from the tip of Ireland to Iceland. There is no short stopping along that. You take off in Iceland and you have to go all the way to Scotland or to Ireland. They're in a different situation, and their numbers are doing very well. The whooper swan is doing very well indeed. Secondly, of course, Iceland is not as icy as the name would suggest. The Hoopers face a different problem. They have to cross the huge expanse of sea, and there is no opportunity to shortstop along that. The Buick, however, is facing into a world of power lines and people with guns and God knows what, all the way down from Siberia, across the tundra into Europe and across over cities, over everything. So the temptation, the incentive to stop short if you can manage it and reduce the risk of death in migration, that is a very real temptation, and I'm sure they avail of it. Of course, what's happening back home is something else. It does the warming up affect the habitat in Siberia? It probably does. Are Arctic foxes more numerous? Are other predators, skuas and things like that, and giant gulls and things, are they more prevalent now? It is a very complex mix, but I wouldn't rush to any one factor theory about decline. It is a complex mix of things.
As far as Buick swans are concerned, Britain and Ireland are the end of the world. There's nowhere else they can go. They don't cross the Atlantic. They don't go any further than that.
But why are they in decline at all? You said the whole species is in decline, not just the crowd that come to Ireland don't come anymore. There's fewer of them to begin with. So why is that?
Well, that's something we can't rush to judgment on. We're not quite certain. There's probably several factors, as Richard said. I think that climate change is a major one. I think that what is almost certainly happening is as the permafrost is thawing in parts of Siberia, it is giving the opportunity for creatures like Arctic foxes and red foxes as well to expand into new areas where they may come into conflict with these birds. They may be reducing, therefore, their nesting success. It could be, for example, that the adults are surviving fine, but that the eggs or the cygnets aren't, so the productivity is going down. So that could be an issue there as well. Of course, we are seeing the Hooper swans doing better. So the Icelandic population has really been increasing, which is why we've been seeing such an increase here of them here in Ireland, because we're the first port of call for those birds, and many of them have no reason to go any further. Last census was done in 2015, and then the subsequent figures from just last year, we saw a 27% increase in the Hooper swan population in Iceland in just 5 years. That's incredibly rapid. So what we are seeing at the moment with the declines in the Buicks and the change in their wintering behaviour and the increase in the Hooper swans, we're seeing massive changes in a really short space of time. And of course, with more Hooper swans, they're bigger than Buick swans, they may compete with them, they're going to have to find somewhere else to go. If that population increases, Ireland won't be enough for them, they'll move more into Britain, they'll move onto the continent, and maybe then they'll push those Buick swans out and make it harder for that species. So I think that the fact that these things are happening so rapidly is the real alarm call to me here, because normally these types of changes would take thousands of years to happen, but in this case it's happening in the space of a decade.
All right, let's get back to Terry Flanagan. Now, Terry, I promised you a little bit of music earlier. I said I'd play Nat King Cole singing Autumn Leaves. Well, this is for you and the current Mrs. Flanagan.
The falling leaves drift by the window, the autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your lips, the summer kisses, the sunburned hands I used to hold. Since you went away.
Oh, there we go now. Wasn't that lovely, everybody? Did you all enjoy that?
We loved it.
Especially for you and the current Mrs. Flanagan, Terence. I hope she enjoys it.
I'm sure she will. And I can tell you one thing, it truly is autumn.
It is.
And Keats, he got it so right when he referred to it as the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness. And, you know, it's at this time of the year that we see these mists. And when he referred to the mellow, he was talking about a slowing down. So the hurry of spring planting and summer growing is now gone. Everything is slowing down as we move into winter. And as for the fruitfulness, well, it's harvest time. Just look around. There's fruits everywhere. And look at the colours, because they're amazing. If we take the reds, you've got the hawthorns and the yews. You've got the beautiful pink spindle fruits at the moment. And black, you've got blackberries and elders. And do you know what? Some plants even produce white berries, like snowberry, how aptly named it is as well. So why are there all these vibrant colours? It costs the plants a lot of energy to produce them. And the answer is, well, very simple, to attract birds and other animals to disperse their seeds. But we know that some of these berries and seeds are extremely poisonous. To find out more about the changing autumnal colours and why some of these fruits and berries are poisonous, I recently paid a visit to the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin, where I met up with Dr. Matthew Jebb, who's director of the gardens.
Oh, lovely.
Now, Terry, have a look at those autumn colours now amongst those trees and shrubs.
They're absolutely spectacular. I can see the greens that are there all the time. I see some lovely oranges, some reds, some creams and some dark reds that are almost black in colour. It's beautiful.
It's one of the great spectacles of autumn, and it's something that every year seems to be slightly different. Mm-hmm. The rate at which that colour appears and how long it stays does vary from year to year.
Now, we're here in the National Botanic Gardens, and we're standing under this very, very large... To me, it looks like a lime tree, am I right?
It is indeed, yes.
Tilia?
Yep.
And we're looking out here in the grounds, and this has to be one of the best times of the year to come to the Botanic Gardens.
Yeah, there's a great deal to see, and we've also got the Sculpture in Context exhibition, which we run every autumn. So that sort of complements the reason to be here, to go for a nice walk, see these remarkable sculptures, new pieces every year, and this blaze of colour that the leaves leave their annual growth with an extraordinary sort of parting shot.
Now, we associate plants in general with the colour green. It's the chlorophyll and the photosynthesis. But now they're changing. Explain why.
I suppose one of the amazing things about light is it's made of photons, and photons do not have colour. The colour that we see in the world around us is made up in our brain, but it's done in a very clever way. We have at the back of our eyeballs these cells that they are designed to look at different wavelengths of light. So we can see different shades of colour. And the reason suddenly all of these leaves are turning yellow and red is because the chlorophyll is being removed from the leaves. Before a tree or a shrub loses its leaves, it breaks down a lot of the photosynthetic apparatus that it's been running all year, and it moves it back into its own tissues, into its bark, and it will store it there to grow new leaves next spring. And so while it's doing that, it removes this chlorophyll. And chlorophyll is an amazing molecule. It captures blue light and red light, but it's not particularly interested in green light. It lets the green light pass it by. And that is why plants look green, because it's the one colour the photosynthesis is not consuming. So the plant is literally absorbing the red and blue to synthesise sugars, and the green light is left over. And therefore, plants look green to us. But now, suddenly, the chlorophyll is disappearing, so the reds and yellows suddenly become obvious, and colours that the leaf has hidden all year under the green, so to speak, like the yellow. This is a compound called carotenes, which is mm-hmm. what colours carrots. And carotenes help the chlorophyll. They capture photons of light and they pass it on to the chlorophyll molecules through the year. But they also don't pass it on if it's too bright, too sunny, and the carotenes help.
So these other pigments, these would have a role in photosynthesis, but surely they're there for something else as well. What about display?
No, they're nothing to do with displaying in a leaf, but they are for display in flowers. The same pigments are used in flowers, carotenes and xanthophylls, these sort of purples,
and all of
blues.
Those, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. These colour up the petals of flowers. Very useful for attracting insects or other pollinators like birds to visit the flowers and even the fruits of a plant.
Well, you've mentioned the fruits there now. Let's just take a little ramble down here because we were looking earlier on there at the nightshades. Now,
the nightshade,
it produces this black fruit. There's lots of different colours of fruit, but the nightshade, this one here, this is the deadly nightshade.
It is, and it's got these wonderful glossy black berries, very attractive looking.
There's no berries on this one here.
No, we've picked them off because at this time of year, we have to be very careful. They are so toxic. They're the sort of thing that a child might find attractive, or even a grown-up might be tempted to think, oh, I wonder what those taste like. And it's one of the great mysteries, I suppose, of the plant world, is how many berries are actually toxic to us human beings. We are not meant to eat them. We are not there to act as the dispersal agent. And evolution has made these fruits toxic to prevent things like mammals with our teeth from grinding up the seeds in them.
So let's go back to the start then. Really, the idea of the berry is a fruit, and the fruit surrounds the seed. And because the plant is immobile or sessile, it can't move from A to B to reproduce or disperse its seeds. It needs to encourage someone, something, to take the seed and spread it. And that's normally birds, is that right?
Well, birds are excellent because they don't have teeth. Birds have a beak, and they prefer soft fruits, and they'll swallow them down whole. And their gizzard down in their stomach crushes the berries, but it doesn't crush the seeds. Whereas mammals, with our teeth, will destroy the seeds in a small fruit. But sometimes smart mammals don't chew the seeds, and an apple is a wonderful example of this. Apples have got little pips filled with cyanide. Now, all of us have eaten apples, and now and again we've accidentally bitten into a seed and we get this quite strong flavour of sort of almonds in the mouth. That is actually cyanide. And
which is very poisonous.
Which is very toxic. But, you know, to kill a human being, you would need to eat well over 50 or 60 seeds of an apple. And at that point, you'd probably be feeling quite sick and you would stop. So an apple has got toxic pips inside a very sweet flavoured fruit. And what happens in the mountains of Central Asia, cave bears eat the fruit, but they're very careful. They do not crush, they don't squash the seeds. So the apple has evolved this ingenious trick to make sure that a bear eats its fruits, does not crush its seeds, and we all know what bears do in the woods. So off the bear goes and disperses the baby seeds.
Okay, if we move over here a little bit, I see a yew tree. And the yew tree has these lovely red berries in it with a black seed on the inside. That seed is also poisonous, am I right?
Yes, yes, highly toxic, as are the leaves of the yew. So the yew is one of these plants with very, very toxic leaves and seeds, but its fruit is non-toxic. But this raises the interesting question that there are a lot of fruits, like holly, for example, that a blackbird can eat. But if we ate holly berries, we would feel very, very sick, because those seeds are full of saponins that actually start to break down your gut. And one of the amazing things about birds is how quickly food transits through their gut. It only takes about an hour and a half before a fruit that a bird has swallowed is coming out the other end.
And the nutrients have been extracted.
Exactly. It's a very fast-acting gut. And they have evolved really to eat these soft, fleshy fruits, which are full of instant nutrients, so to speak, whereas our gut takes, gosh, a day and a half to process food. So anything that a mammal eats will usually reside in the guts for upwards of 2 days. And of course, a poison will get to work then. So these birds are able to eat these toxic fruits to us of holly, the deadly nightshade, the yew. And because they're passing through their gut so quickly, the seed exits the other end and doesn't do them any harm.
Now, I saw over in this direction, I'm going to move a little bit further this way again, because you had some rowan trees. And
yes,
the rowan
yes.
trees that you have here, they have the lovely red berries. Now, there are some, because I've one outside the house, and it's got the lovely yellow berries.
Yes.
And the one thing I notice every year, two things. First of all, the birds, they don't start to eat those yellow berries until all of the red berries on all of the accompanying trees on the estate are gone. And the second thing is, all of a sudden, a thrush appears. I never see him all summer, and he guards that tree with his life. And any starling or anything else that comes, bang, he sets them off on their ways.
Yes, one of the wonderful things, especially with the big missel thrush, is as autumn approaches, they start to guard a few trees. So they will move their territory to take in trees covered in fruits, because it's the larder. It's going to see them through the winter. And it's quite tragic to watch, often in late December and January, when the red wings and field fares arrive, that poor old thrush has a terrible battle to defend its larder from the raiders. But it's an interesting point you make about the yellow fruits of sorbus, because some sorbus have even white fruits, and birds will almost ignore them completely. And what we've discovered is these white-fruited sorbuses are apomixts. That means they do not rely on sexual reproduction. The fruits are set automatically. So it's an evolutionary sort of dead end. They're no longer evolving these things, and they are producing fruits that are not attractive to birds. And the fact that they therefore don't get dispersed well is a sort of a side issue to them. But essentially, they're doomed to extinction, because having a bright red fruit is so important to attract the birds in. And it's not just the colour, because birds have got far better vision than us. They've got four sets of cones in the back of their eyes. They are tetrachromatic compared to our trichromatic vision, and this means they can also see ultraviolet light. And many of these fruits that look coloured red, yellow to us have also got bright white ultraviolet reflectors on them. So essentially glowing light is coming out of them that the birds can see. And so the bird can spot them amongst the green foliage very, very easily.
This year seems to have been a particularly good year for berries.
Yes, I've noticed that the hawthorn hedgerows in North Dublin are filled with fruits this year. And probably that goes to the fact that back in the spring when we had a very good pollination set. So sometimes if we don't have any late frosts, we get a very good set of fruit. And the holly trees also, a lot of them look as though they're in good fruit this year. And again, we will see those hanging on to their fruits. Whilst there's a lot of mythology around when the fruits hang about on the trees for a long time, it tells you that you're having a hard winter. It's not the case. It just means that the birds haven't needed to turn to them early on, and therefore we get the persistent fruits. So it's been very mild so far this autumn, and therefore the trees are still covered in fruit.
Should people collect these berries at this time of the year so that they can plant them out next year?
Certainly. I think everybody should be encouraged to gather a few rowan berries, holly berries, clean the fruit off them, the flesh off them, and then plant them out in a pot before the winter. So it's best to put them in a pot, cover them over with sand or grit, and when all the little seedlings come up, then transfer them into individual pots. And then by the following year, they'll be big enough to fend for themselves.
So how long will the colours last here in the Botanic Gardens? It's looking spectacular at the moment. Will we get a couple of weeks out of it?
It'll all depend on the wind. If we get big gales coming through, it'll strip those leaves off in no time. So as long as the leaves stay hanging on the trees, they will develop stronger and stronger colours. But if the big wind comes through, they'll disappear overnight.
So if the weather stays calm, it's a good time then to come to the Botanic Gardens. And of course, it's free.
It is, and it's an extraordinary facility. So not only have you got the pleasure of every plant having a label on it, but you've also got, you know, wonderful walks to be had here. And when the leaves are lying on the ground, it is a spectacle to behold.
And a lovely time to visit the Botanic Gardens, Terry. Autumn.
Yeah, well, do you know what, Derek? The Botanic Gardens are a fantastic place to visit at any time of the year. I know if you go in the springtime, you see all those magnificent bulbs when they have all the daffodils and the tulips there. In the summertime, you see all that lovely, luscious green growth. But my favourite time has to be this time of the year when you're seeing all of those colours. The colours are spectacular there at the moment, not just in the leaves, but like Matthew was saying, in the berries as well. So, look, I would recommend it to anybody to get out there in these autumn days before it gets into winter. Go up and visit it. And remember, it's free.
It's free. And you know what? I'll never look at berries the same way again. Annie, you're looking at me like you want to say something.
Well, yes, there's berries and berries. I know Matthew was talking about the white berries mm-hmm. of the mountain ash of the Rhone. But there's another white berry. It's the snowberry. It has little pink flowers as a flower, but it has these white berries. And they're like lumps of polystyrene for all the world. You could squish them. Now, they are completely useless for birds. Birds don't eat them at all. This is kind of an invasive species. We're not encouraging people to plant this in their hedgerows. So in fact, it's a white berry that seems to me to be of no use to wildlife at all, and we don't need it. The birds won't go near that, do they, Niall?
No, and I think that's the reason why many of these ornamental plants and indeed mutant varieties of things like rowan with white berries have become popular in gardens. It's because people didn't want the birds eating them. They wanted them to have them there as garden ornaments. Now, that seems completely alien to me. I want the birds to come and eat the berries in my garden, but I guess some people didn't like that. They wanted to keep that display there for throughout the winter months so that it would look magnificent for as long as possible. So I think that's why these became cultivated in gardens. Because, of course, with the berries, usually the darker the berry, particularly in the darker shades of red or indeed purple to black, that's a signal to the birds that there is the highest level of sugar in those berries.
Oh, I thought it was a sign of danger. And I was about to say, but they always eat those.
No, well, so birds have different biology to us, so they can process some chemicals that we can't. But a lot of those berries that we think of as poisonous aren't to humans. Before I caveat with what I'm about to say by saying, please, if you do not know what you're doing, do not pick berries off bushes and eat them without realising what you're doing. But things like rowan berries, they're actually edible. They can be made into jam. Honestly, not particularly nice, but they're not dangerous.
It's a lovely jelly that you have with venison, not jam on your toast. And you can eat elderberries as well. Again, bitter and sour, but cooked into it with sugars, are edible.
They are. Just a warning of the elderberries can have a strong laxative effect, so just be careful of that.
They have a laxative effect on the pigeons that eat them and sit on the electric wires above my car.
But then you also have things like the hawthorn, hawberries, like the white thorn. They're perfectly edible. They don't taste particularly nice, but they're in some parts of Europe and in Asia particularly, those are popular food and they're very high in
so vitamins
and minerals.
But back to the colours. So the darker and the redder they are, then there's more sugar in them, and the birds want those. Now, me and Aina Nilauna, place dropping here. Where were we, Aina? What am I about to say? Think now, think.
Eating berries?
No, no, nothing to do with berries at all, but it has to do with colours. Costa Rica and the rainforest.
Oh, yes.
And remember
yes.
the frogs.
The one and only place you ever went with me, Derek. And you've never been able to forget the magnificent time we had.
But think of the colour of the frogs, remember? And they were so brightly coloured because it was a warning sign.
It's a warning colour, yes, yeah. But I mean, there's warning colours. I mean, it's the same with the red flowers. The bees can't see the red flowers, but that doesn't mean the birds can't see the red berries.
Poisoned arrow frogs, that was the name of the frog.
Yeah. They have nasty tasting flesh as well. So it depends on what you are eating and what you've learned by the colours. But the colours certainly carry a very strong message. And the message of the ripe fruits are, we're really, really ripe. Do please eat us, because the seeds will come out the other end and a new tree or whatever will grow.
Exactly. So that's, it's sort of the bribe from the tree or the bush, so that the birds will help to propagate the species. They'll spread the seeds as they eat them. If you think about some of the red berries we humans like, you think of strawberries and raspberries. They're very sweet. And you know, if you're picking blackberries as well, you don't go for the green ones or the reddish ones. You wait until they're totally purple, because they'll be the sweetest. So that's a signal. That's what the birds want. They want the energy. One of my favourite of all bribes and sort of arrangements they have with berries is what's happened with the chili plants. There's several different species of chili pepper. Aina's sticking her tongue out here. She doesn't like them. I do quite like them. Chili peppers, they're a type of berry or type of fruit. They have evolved to have a chemical in them that's very distasteful to mammals, but not to birds. So that's capsaicin, that burning chemical we get when we eat chili. That's for most animals, that's for most mammals, that's extremely unpleasant. It actually triggers the same receptors in the tongue as extreme heat. So you feel like you've been burned. Birds aren't capable of detecting that. And you might think, well, why would a plant want to distinguish between birds and mammals, let's say like rats or mice? That's because birds don't have teeth. So they'll eat the fruit and they'll swallow those seeds whole. They'll pass through the digestive tract of the bird undamaged and come out the other end. Whereas mammals have teeth. They'll crush those seeds. They'll destroy them. That's no use at all to the plant. So chilies have developed a chemical that's incredibly distasteful to mammals, but it's incredibly pleasant to birds.
So if you're putting out bird seed or bird nuts and you don't want the squirrels eating them, as some people don't, if you lace them with plenty of chili pepper, the squirrels won't eat them, but the birds will.
Yes, and it really does work. So the birds can't detect that taste. Only the mammals like the squirrels and the rats can.
There's a series on Netflix called We Are the Champions. I don't know if you've happened upon it or not. And it's all about unusual competitions which take place around the world. And one has to do with eating chilies.
Ah.
And the hotter, the better. What is it that makes a person want to eat a chili? Why would you like to eat a chili knowing it's going to have that negative effect on you?
Because it releases endorphins that make you feel good. Now, I'm not a huge chili eater. I have quite a high tolerance for food from my travels. Probably it's lessened a bit now since COVID, because I haven't been abroad for a while. But I've travelled, you know, in Asia and in the West Indies, where people eat a lot of hot food. I think what happens is tolerance builds up over time. So you do get used to it and you don't have the same reaction. But people do get this sort of feel-good chemical from it, like a dopamine hit when they have these hot, spicy foods.
I remember when lecturing in Bolton Street, we had students from other parts of the world and they couldn't believe, like, people that came from countries where there was lots and lots of spicy food, how bland and boring our Irish food was. They couldn't believe that you could eat mashed potatoes just like with maybe a bit of salt, whereas they'd be lashing on the chili pepper to give it a bit of taste.
Anyway, Richard.
Yes, Derek and Niall and Anna, I'm intrigued by this discussion. Why would certain plants choose to have red berries when they don't want them? You take a bramble. A bramble starts out with red berries, very conspicuous, at the time when it doesn't wish to attract birds. And then when it does want the birds to eat the berries, they turn black and become far harder to see. Why does a bramble choose this curious reversal of colours? Everything else goes bright red when you want to be eaten. They do the opposite.
They don't really. I was gathering blackberries the other day and the sun shining. And when they were ripe, the black ones were shining, they were glistening. The red ones were kind of a dull, and I'm not colourblind, the red ones were kind of a dull sort of red. And even before they're red, they're green berries. They're green and then they're red. But then they get this big, lustrous, coloured, shining black, purple, gorgeous. And you wouldn't want to be going near them old red ones at all. They looked great and they were the ripe ones to pick. So, I mean, I do think on a warm, bright autumn day and the sun shining, you wouldn't look at anything only the big lustrous black ones, even if you were a bird.
And of course, we're looking at them through human eyes, and birds' eyes are different. Birds see a greater range of colours than we do. We know that they can see some colours in the ultraviolet part of the spectrum, and maybe some berries are giving off that kind of sheen. That may be the case. But certainly we know that birds like blackbirds, that rely very much on these red berries, particularly in the winter, their eyes are capable of distinguishing between different shades of red 40 times better than the human eye. And that's so they can pick the the peak moment of ripeness. So they're much more attuned to that even than the human eye is. But of course, we humans, we are attuned to fruit ripeness as well. It's been an important part of our evolution. And that means that we humans, like our fellow primates, so lemurs and monkeys and apes and so on, we have much better colour vision than most mammals. So we're worse than birds, but much better than most mammals. Most mammals see the world in a very muted colour palette. They might many see the world just in black and white. And the thought what happened was, mammals evolved mainly to be nocturnal. Our ancient ancestors, back when we were little shrew-like creatures, they came out at night. They didn't need good colour vision, so they lost that ability, transferred it to be able to see well at night. Many mammals have stayed that way. They have good nocturnal vision, not great daytime vision. But it seems primates re-evolved colour vision to enable us to work out when fruits were of our peak ripeness. So our early monkey ancestors were picking ripe fruit, and that's where our colour vision re-established itself and came back. So we kind of re-evolved it, or our ancestors did. So we kind of are a bit in between. We don't see the world in as colourful a way as birds do, but we see it much more colourful way than, say, cats or dogs or mice do.
Or bulls. Bulls don't see red rags at all.
That's right. It's the motion of the cape that gets the bullfighter in danger there.
Well, there you go, Terry. See what happens when you do a report?
That's what it's all about, Derek.
Too true. Talk to you next week, Terry. Bye.
Bye.
There goes Terry Flanagan now. Wally the Walrus. Do you remember Wally the Walrus, Niall?
Remember him. I actually got to see him. It was the first walrus I ever saw, and I popped down to see him when he was at Ardmore in County Waterford.
Well, the adventures of Wally the Walrus have become something of an epic Disney-esque journey. The marine mammal, which is native to the Arctic Ocean, was first spotted near Valentia Island in March and has since taken a most circuitous trip of several thousand kilometres over 6 months and was last seen in Iceland. Wally has been making headlines here and around the world.
Like an explorer in the new world, he first set flipper on the shores of Southern Ireland last spring.
He's huge.
Next stop, the coast of Wales. They called him Wally, naturally. A 4-year-old one-ton Arctic walrus was later spotted as far south as France and the waters off northern Spain. And then back to Ireland, this time County Cork. And finally, a 3-week 900-kilometer swim to Iceland. One worry is that walruses are losing sea ice to climate change and venturing further from the Arctic.
They're losing habitat. So we can expect to see more and more of those Arctic species becoming vagrants and becoming displaced from their native habitats.
That was Melanie Crosey of Seal Rescue Ireland bringing that report to an end. And Melanie joins us now from her home in Wexford. So Melanie, Wally the Walrus, a quick recap if you would please.
Yeah, so Wally the Walrus was first spotted in March back in Valentia Island. And then from there, he traveled all throughout Europe, kind of wreaking havoc wherever he went, but also getting a lot of attention. There was a kind of a global movement following this walrus, and everyone just fell in love with him. He was a real character, and he did like to climb up on boats and ribs. And I do think that he really raised a lot of awareness about the threats facing wildlife, just disturbance and habitat loss. And we're just absolutely delighted that he's made it so far all the way back up to Iceland, and he's so close to be back at home in the Arctic.
So that's where he is now, Iceland, for sure, absolutely 100%.
100%. So it had been about 3 weeks since he hadn't been spotted. And within that time, there was a walrus that had been spotted in Germany. So, of course, we all immediately assumed that that was Wally. But we inspected the photos and we were able to identify it was a different walrus. That one was not only female, but had different scars and markings and also shorter tusks. So when we came across the photo on Instagram of a seal in Iceland, we immediately pulled up photos and we compared them. And it was an exact match. So this is absolutely our Wally the Walrus who's up in Iceland. And last I heard, he's still there. He's got a favorite little boat slip that he rests on for up to 12 hours at a time. And he's been observed feeding, swimming around, and then he'll come back and rest. So he's got to replace all that energy that he lost on that extremely long swim from Ireland to Iceland.
Now, I've only ever seen a walrus once in my lifetime, and that was at the New York State Aquarium on Coney Island. And that was a long time ago, 1992, if I'm not mistaken. I was involved with the project to repatriate a Kemp's Ridley turtle that had washed up on Bannerstrand in County Kerry. And they are big animals. But that was not there by its own volition. It was brought there and was put on public display for our entertainment. It has to be unusual for a walrus to start, I don't even say befriending humans, but coming so close to us.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm with you. I don't think I've actually ever seen a walrus in real life before WALL-E. And I think that is basically the case for most people. So I completely understand the enthusiasm and the fascination that so many people had. Now, it did become a bit of an issue when so many crowds showed up and people were getting too close. Boats were coming right up to him. People were sticking cameras in his face. You know, this is not only stressful for a wild animal, but it's also very dangerous. He is a large animal. He's 800 kilos. He's basically the size of a bull.
Big.
And he isn't really used to being around humans. You know, in the wild, they are very social with their own kind. But here in Ireland and all over Europe, there were no other walruses for him to be hanging out with. So it was kind of strange and a little bit endearing, but he kept showing up in really bustling harbors. And I do think it was because of that social nature. So it did come down to us to kind of be responsible and really put the word out there to please respect him from a distance, because he does need to rest. And any deviation from natural behavior is considered disturbance. So even if he was looking up from people approaching him, it meant he wasn't resting. He wasn't able to save those vital energy stores. So we did work very hard in collaboration with a number of other organizations across Europe and the UK to try to establish safe resting sites for him wherever he would go. So that not only would protect him, but it also would protect people and also protect property, because he did have that habit of sinking expensive boats.
Mind you, this really goes to show the power of social media. Listening and looking at the hoo-ha over WALL-E, you would think it was the first time ever a walrus had come down to these waters. And in fact, the first walrus in these parts of the world was recorded way back in 1894. One was recorded off Valencia, and on and off during the whole of the 1900s, we've had visits from walruses. But this one was the way it was going on. It was all linked to climate change, ice in the Arctic, everything else. Whereas, in fact, other times they visited us and there was no talk of habitat change. So maybe this business of a teenager going off on a skate to visit the world is something walruses do anyway, not necessarily linked to Arctic ice melting, which of course it is.
Well, it is true that walruses have been spotted in Irish waters as early as, you know, around 1900. But then there wasn't another sighting for about 80 years. And since then, there have been 20 sightings. And not only that, but now a second walrus in Germany. So, you know, the thing with climate change is, yes, like, there are events that take place once a decade or once a century. But what's happening more and more is these events that are supposed to be happening once a decade or once a century are happening every year or even twice a year. So that's where red flags really start to show up. In addition to walruses, we're seeing lots of other Arctic species make their way down as well. Just last year, Seal Rescue Ireland rescued a ringed seal, which was only the second ringed seal ever spotted in Ireland. And she was successfully rehabbed and released. But right now, as we speak, Scotland has a ringed seal. So we are seeing an increase in frequency, and it does make sense that as sea ice melts, as it's rapidly doing more and more quickly every day, that they are becoming displaced. In other parts of the world, walruses are being forced to climb on top of tall cliffs. And if you've seen Our Planet, you've kind of seen the results of that, where they actually tragically fall off the cliffs due to habitat loss. So here, our Atlantic population, they might not be climbing on cliffs, but instead, they might be swimming out trying to find new areas. And the unfortunate reality is it's possible that our WALL-E, the walrus, is one of the lucky ones who actually made landfall. There could be a large number of walruses that are out in the middle of the Atlantic right now that we'll never hear of or see. So it is just really important to take these cases and apply them to a larger subset of data. And we are seeing an increase in this trend, and it really is something to pay attention to.
Melanie, I had the great pleasure of going down to actually see WALL-E myself when he was just off the coast of an area near Ardmore in County Waterford. You and I were chatting there actually about him, and we could see that there were already crowds gathering. Now, when I was watching him there, he was out at sea. He was actually seemed to be feeding. He wasn't being disturbed, and I had the great pleasure of watching him from a great height. So he couldn't even see me, so there was no disturbance there. But I was aware that as a celebrity grew, and we, you know, people had learned about him all over Europe, there really was a rush from people who might might describe themselves as being eco-tour companies to try to get out close to him. People were treating him almost like he was a cartoon character. When, of course, he's this massive animal who's away from home, has probably never really encountered human beings before, so he doesn't really know how to react to us other than when he turned up in Wales and in Cornwall and so on. How much of a concern would that be when people do tend to try to get too close to these animals? And what would you recommend in those circumstances to tour companies who are trying to sort of capitalise on the appearance of these creatures?
Absolutely, great question. Because, of course, public perception is changing. Just in the last few years, there's such a growing interest in wildlife, in the environment, in marine mammals. So there is an opportunity for ecotourism to be a really growing industry. And it doesn't necessarily have to be at the exploitation or at the expense of wild animals. We just have to make sure we're doing it responsibly. So what we were recommending is to everyone to keep at least 100 meters away. And to just remember that they are sensitive animals. You have to observe quietly with binoculars or a good zoom lens and just make sure that you're not disturbing their behavior. And in Ardmore was a perfect example of this because you were able to look down from great heights, like you said, not disturb him in any way, but really enjoy watching him and learning about him. And, you know, I think that we just need to take that enthusiasm and interest and harness it in a responsible manner. And to be honest with you, I think that this wall and the social media and all of the issues about disturbance and harassment really did make an impact. In fact, we're seeing a change in behavior already. So right now, it's our gray seal pupping season. So our native pinnipeds, so Wally's cousins, are coming up on the coastlines now having their pups. And due to how much of a spotlight was put on the walrus and about keeping a safe distance, this has resulted in fewer seals needing to be rescued so far this year. More and more people are aware that if you see a resting animal on the beach, to keep your distance. And people were kind of regulating themselves. We have a community conservation program now where coastal communities are actually taking ownership over the seals that come up on their own coastlines and educating the public, even in some cases roping off coastlines until those pups are big enough to go off into the water in order to protect them, but also to be able to safely observe and enjoy them from afar. So as a society, we're actually making huge steps in a really short period of time. And I do think that some of this is thanks to Wally.
Let's hope it is. And you referred to the term there, pinnipeds. That's flippered feet, isn't it? The seals are pinnipeds and the walrus is the largest of the seals. And that's the group they belong to, the pinnipeds. So, Richard, do you want to say something on this?
Yes, Derek. Cast your mind back a few years to our visit to the Netherlands. We went to Harderwijk, associated with our good friend Linnaeus. Now, they have a SeaWorld there with lots of walruses performing. Now, many of these institutions have gone to the wall with COVID and so on and so forth. And the fact that our friend climbs onto boats so readily, Wally, he climbs onto boats. That's what he would have done in SeaWorld. Now, if these places are going to the wall, are they releasing walruses quietly back to the sea?
They couldn't be doing that. Surely.
Well, hold on a minute now. Look at the way he behaves.
Hold on a minute yourself. I mean, surely they'd have some kind of tracking device. And what do they put in dogs now when they're travelling? They give them little chips so they can trace the owners and the history of the animal and all that. Surely you couldn't just release an animal from a zoo. I would have thought it would make perfect sense to microchip every animal behind bars or in a cage, whatever the case may be, in case it got out. So you'd know where it came from. Because people do have private collections, not so much in this country, but in other countries.
Well, I don't know, but I'm looking at the strange behaviour. Now, it seems he is compensating. Walruses are very sociable creatures. Tens of thousands gather at certain sites. He's missing all that. And he seems to use people. He seems to like people looking at him and making a fuss of him. And I think he's compensating for his lack of his own kind. He's using people as his company, perhaps. But I think the greatest mystery about this is actually his trip to Iceland. Remember, walruses can dive a few hundred metres, 500 or something like that, for clams at the bottom of the sea. Now, if he is to cross over to Iceland, he has to cross extremely deep sea, the Porcupine Bank Canyon and various places. And suddenly, he's out over ferociously deep water and he can't feed, he can't hunt anymore. How does he managed to do that? And he's, after all, he's not on a regular migration route. He's never done anything like this before. It is an extraordinary mystery that this creature can head out off the continental shelf and target Iceland. What does Melanie think of all this?
Melanie, I am curious about what Richard has just said there. Is it possible that this animal could possibly have been released from some institution?
That's an interesting theory. This is the first time I'm hearing of it. I wouldn't know one way or another. I do know that with microchips, you actually have to scan them with a scanner up close. And to my knowledge, when he was showing up in any of these spots around our coastlines, no one had access to a scanner or was getting close enough to scan him. So I don't know if there's any evidence to support it, but there's no evidence to say that that's not the case, that he was released intentionally or maybe escaped from a zoo. But, you know, there are other walruses that are showing up here and there. And it does make sense, you know, if they rely on ice and they're losing ice, that they might be resorting to exploring new territories. Now, your question about us heading off over open waters, yes, it's a very, very long swim. And we knew that would be ahead of him based on his distance he had covered previously to that. So this is why we were putting such a heavy focus on allowing him to rest, allowing him to feed, allowing him to gather his strength and blubber, basically, for that long swim. And it's the same with many marine mammals. They rely on thick, dense layers of blubber. Not only does that insulate them from cold waters, but it also is a huge, huge energy store so that they can go days, potentially weeks, without feeding because they've got that energy store. Now, when he showed up in Iceland, he had definitely lost some weight during that journey, and that does make sense. But over the past 2 weeks, since he's been there, he's been resting, and God bless them, they've been doing a great job of allowing him to rest. They've even blocked off his little boat slip so that no one gets too close to him, and he's been seen going in and out of the harbor, actively feeding and restoring that lost energy. So the hope is, if this can continue, then he'll be able to make that final leg of his journey all the way up north and be back with his own kind.
One thing I must ask you, has anybody seen him blush? Walruses are unique among sea mammals is that they go bright red, as I used to do when I was a teenager. So I have a soft spot for blushers. Does this fella blush? He's not blushing out of embarrassment, I might add, but he blushes to balance the heat flow in his body and things like that. But you should have it on tape somewhere, a blushing walrus in Ireland.
I have not seen him blush, and all of the photos that I saw of him, and I had visited him in Ardmore and also spent a week in Crookhaven when he was down there. And he appeared to be pretty uniform and brown. I mean, absolutely gorgeous, stunning animal. He did have a few scars, but overall, pretty uniform colors. So I'm not sure. I mean, this was in not only in an Irish summer, but it was during a heat wave. So he was just trying to keep himself cool by going for frequent dips in the cool water. So I'm not sure if the blushing might be a result of them being cold. Maybe they do that in colder climates in order to keep themselves warm. But to my knowledge, we didn't see him do that in these lower latitudes.
Well, it's interesting to know that he's still out there and people are keeping an eye on him. And as Aina was saying, it is the power of social media. We know what's going on. We're able to see him. We're able to photograph him. We're able to know, yeah, it's definitely him. Look at this mark here or that mark there. Look out for his blush. That's what people will be looking out for. Melanie, lovely to speak with you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very interesting stuff indeed. That's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to Richard Collins, to Aina Nilan and Niall Hatch and Terry Flanagan. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland and our researcher is John Bella Riley. Visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.